developing those relationships over time has really helped us drive more conservation. We'll start off in the watershed with one little project, and then all of a sudden their neighbors are interested and they see the benefits. You know, at first they don't want to work with the government, you're right. Mm-hmm. And then they see the success and the improvement on the farm, and then the neighbor, their next door neighbor will want to talk to us then and say, oh, you know, tell me more about that. I'm interested now.
Hi, and welcome to the Conservation in HD podcast series. I'm Kaylin Clements, and I am a social scientist in the Human Dimensions branch of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service at the Natural Resource Program Center in Fort Collins, Colorado. This podcast is our effort to put tools and resources into the hands of natural resource practitioners and is a collaboration with the National Conservation Training Center. Today, we'll be exploring collaborative conservation. Here with me today is Heidi Coyler, a fish habitat biologist for the Fish and Wildlife Service and coordinator for the Fishers and Farmers Partnership for the Upper Mississippi River Basin. Fun fact about Heidi is that she grew up in the watershed where Aldo Leopold and Hugh Hammond Bennett worked to start the nation's first watershed project, the Coon Creek Watershed Project. Heidi, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks, Kaylin, for inviting me.
And we also have here in the studio Todd Sutphin, the Senior Operations Manager for the Iowa Soybean Association's Environmental Programs and Services Department. And Todd was telling me earlier how proud he is to work for a commodity group that does have a department like this that focuses on the environment. Thanks so much for being here, Todd.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you.
So to start off, I just would love to hear you guys tell me a little bit about how this collaboration got started, how the Fishers and Farmers Partnership got started.
Well, in 2008, we had visionaries from the Driftless area get together, and they saw the success there of both productive fisheries and productive farms side by side. And they took that idea and they talked to other movers and shakers, such as Roger Wolf from Iowa Soybean Association, Martin Conrad from Iowa DNR. Of course, the Fish and Wildlife Service was involved, U.S. Geological Survey. And they all got together and they wanted to put more conservation on the ground. And they thought by working with the farmers, getting out of the typical trout stream projects that we have done in the past and getting up on the landscape, we might be able to do more conservation.
Oh, okay. Very cool. So how did it evolve from there? Like, what have the players changed to since then? And when was that again?
So it started in 2008.
Okay, 2008.
And we became a formal partnership in 2009. So we are part of the National Fish Habitat Partnership. And we now include members from all five states. So the entire Upper Mississippi River Basin. So that's Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Missouri. And so we work together and work with our local partners. And that's really what helps drive conservation is that local partner, whether it's a county employee, whether it's a non-government organization, really helps to have that local person involved, because that's who people trust, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to trust your neighbor. You're going to trust other farmers. You're going to trust your friends. And so it really comes down to who are you going to trust? You know, me walking in from a federal agency, say, hey, you know, here, I'm here to help. You know, that's not going to cut it. It really helps when you have local people driving the conservation, whether that's the farmers or local watershed groups. Mm-hmm. It really helps to have that.
Awesome. So speaking of, I feel like this is a great time to ask Todd how the Iowa Soybean Association plays a role in the partnership and the collaboration.
Sure. So the Iowa Soybean Association, obviously a commodity group, and farmers by nature are problem solvers. You help them understand issues and you provide them science and information. They want to figure out how to fix an issue. And so by being part of the partnership, it brings together multiple groups and agencies together to talk about these issues and help farmers better understand, okay, so this is what I'm facing. Help me understand how I can do better, how I can implement a change.
So do you two work together frequently? And how does that normally go? Like, what do you guys normally work on together?
I wouldn't say Todd and I work together on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. It's other members of Iowa Soybean Association, too. So okay. Right now, Adam Keel is on our steering committee. And before Adam, we had Chris Jones from the lab. So the way we work together is go together on field days in the watersheds we work on. So there might be a field day, and then either Adam or someone else from Iowa Soybean will come and present to the farmers. And then sometimes we'll have our rainfall simulator there on display, showing different cover crops and different farming practices and how they impact the soils and runoff and also percolation. So there are different things that we work on the field days. Sometimes we work together on a field day where we seine an oxbow, because we work together in the Boone watershed and we do oxbow restoration. So we're trying to work there for an endangered species called the Topeka shiner.
Oh, wow.
And so what we'll do is we'll bring a seine and then seine the oxbow, and Iowa Soybean Association will be there, Iowa DNR, the Nature Conservancy. So for us, the Nature Conservancy really helps drive that project, as well as Iowa Soybean, because, you know, they're both local. They're both there in the watershed working with the farmers. And so we try to bring outside resources that may not be there, whether it's funding, technical services, things like that, that maybe they need. Mm-hmm. And then we can offer up those as far as whatever they need to help them there in the watershed.
For us working together, the Fishers and Farmers Partnership, they identify or outline priority watersheds in the five states. And one of the priority watersheds in Iowa is the Boone River watershed. The Iowa Soybean Association's been up in the Boone River since about 2004, working with farmers on various watershed practices and projects, water monitoring, and looking at new and emerging practices. And one of those practices that we started to explore was the use of oxbows, a stream meander that's been cut off from the stream. And one of the projects that Fishers and Farmers funded was the restoration of these oxbows for multiple or stack benefits. So you got the fishers community that are interested in Topeka shiner and the endangered species. Farmers are looking at it as a way for flood control and water quality. And so we're not only getting water quality improvement, but we're also building habitat for Topeka shiner. So it's a multiple benefit, multiple win for both ag and the environment.
Wow, that's really cool. I love that endangered species is kind of coming up and that there are benefits for everybody involved.
And one thing that one of our cornerstones at the Iowa Soybean Association is water monitoring.
Okay.
We've been doing water monitoring for the last 20 years.
Why is that?
So farmers we're big on science and data. And we let science kind of drive some of these issues, and we let science and data help maybe identify ways forward. So oftentimes our farmers or stakeholders, landowners, want to know what the conditions are. Mm-hmm. So water monitoring can provide that baseline. But then if we put a practice in and they want to know, well, how is it performing? We can actually utilize that data to show performance over time. We've had farmers think that, they're following what they've been taught, maybe how their dad did it. They thought they were doing a really good job farming. And they are doing a good job, but there might be areas they can improve on. Water monitoring at the local level, at the local scale, maybe their field level, we can come in and say, provide some monitoring and show them, well, maybe there's some areas on your farm that we could show some improvement. We had one farmer in the Boone that thought he was doing a great job. We did some baseline monitoring. He realized he was actually contributing to some of the issues that his watershed was seeing. We helped him implement some practices, and one of those being a bioreactor, and then he installed cover crops. And we were able to show over time a reduction in this effluent water going to the stream. So it was a great learning experience, and it's how science and data can help shape how farmers make decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome. And so speaking of some of those benefits, collaborative conservation can take a lot of time and effort. What makes it worth it for you all?
Well, for us, just having the more conservation on the ground is, you know, what we're really trying to get at. So it helps. And a lot of these projects may not have started without partners like Iowa Soybean or Minnesota Corn Growers or some of our other partners that we work with. because they trust them, you know, and I understand that, you know, if someone came knocking on my door that was from the government, you know, I'm not sure I would open the door either. So, I completely understand. So it's been really, really exciting to see different partners that we work with too, you know. It's always not your typical partners, you know. We have businesses that we work with that you wouldn't normally think that would fund some of these projects, or Minnesota Corn Growers took one of our projects and funded it, which was a trout stream project. You'd never guess a commodity group would fund a typical trout stream project. So it's really exciting to see this.
As Heidi said, we wear a different hat. You know, we're a commodity group. You don't normally see a conservation program within the commodity group. Yeah, so when we come to a watershed meeting, they feel more comfortable talking about the issues that they're facing, because they know that we're not out to regulate them, we're not out to control, we're just here to help them make better decisions so they can continue farming, but also deal with some of the natural resource issues that they're facing on their farms.
Mm-hmm. Right.
One thing about conservation collaboration and the time, I oftentimes like to say that when you work in a watershed, you get who you get. You've got your leaders, and then you got your laggards, or your early adopters and those that might be more skeptical.
Ooh, what's that called again?
It's diffusion of innovation. Yeah, it's the theory of diffusion of innovation.
Yeah,
and
that's awesome.
The diffusion curve. So oftentimes when we start a watershed project, we identify those leaders. There might be 8 to 12 leaders, and we bring those individuals in to begin the discussion. And from there, we can build that network of farmer leaders that will help maybe start implementing practices and start sharing what they've learned with their neighbors to bring others along that curve, that adoption curve. Mm-hmm. So that takes time. And then on the partnership side, we've built our program on partnerships. Last year alone, we worked with over 80 different partners in various capacities. That could be from a local water quality group to state agency to a federal government. But it's the partnerships that help bring these projects together, because it unifies different folks, different groups together, trying to achieve the goals of that watershed group. And that does take time to bring everyone kind of in alignment, make sure they understand what the end game is, and working together to achieve that.
Mm-hmm. Our state partners, too, sometimes have a problem finding match dollars on some of our projects for Fish and Wildlife Service.
Mm.
But what they find is working together, they come up with some creative solutions that they wouldn't have otherwise on their own in their own agency. So we found the benefits of working together in fishers and farmers too. And it excites them because they get to come work with their steering committee that they get to see. And they develop these relationships where instead of handshakes, now we're hugging each other and
wow.
Talking about different projects that we can be working on large scale, you know, instead of these little watersheds. Well, let's start, you know, changing people's ideas or thoughts about this issue. Let's focus on this issue. So it's not just projects now, it's issues. And that's where the social piece comes in. And so we try to bring in a facilitator in our Watershed Leaders Network. And she comes in and helps us discuss some of these issues with some of our farmer leaders that we work with.
And so speaking of, could you each actually tell me a little bit about how facilitation helps make your work successful?
Well, for us, it's having a third party and not having, you know, with a Fish and Wildlife Service and farmer groups, they see two sides, right?
Right.
But when you bring in that facilitator, there aren't sides anymore. It's like, let's have a discussion. Let's work on this together, because without working together, we're not going to come to a solution.
Mm-hmm. Would you say something around the same?
Yeah, for us, it's a locally led effort. I mean, these farmers live and work in these watersheds. I can come in and work on a watershed project, but I go back to the office. These guys stay and work. Mm-hmm. And so the success of a local watershed project is based on the commitment and the efforts of those that live and work there. So for us to think that we can come in and write a watershed plan without their involvement is pretty naive. We really need their input, their guidance, and their acceptance of that to make this happen. If you don't have it, it's going to be a plan that's written. It's going to be put on the shelf and never used.
Yeah. Yep, I've heard that before. Okay. So something that you both keep touching on that I love, and it's sort of the beauty of collaborative conservation, is that you can accomplish things together that you would never be able to accomplish individually. So now that we know all of the great things that collaborative conservation can help us succeed in, what are some of the biggest barriers that you have come across in trying to be successful in collaboration in your experience?
Well, what I've seen, especially with federal agencies, there's a lot of bureaucracy and a lot of strings that are tied to the funding, a lot of accountability, a lot of reporting. And we don't have to just report to the Fish and Wildlife Service, but we have to report to many different agencies. And so it's really hard. We've actually had farmers tell us that they don't want to work with NRCS or they don't want to work with the Fish and Wildlife Service. And it's because of that bureaucracy. And I completely agree with them. And I wish there was more. And I try to do what I can to make it as flexible as I can. You know, I try to work with our partners and see if there's different ways that we can still, you know, implement this practice, you know, and not have 50 pages of paperwork that you have to fill out. And so, you know, if we could just remove some of those strings, some of that bureaucracy, and go back to the way things were, we might have much more success on the landscape. And because of all of that bureaucracy and red tape, that's why I go to partners like Iowa Soybean Association or our non-government organizations, because they don't have to deal with that.
Right.
And that's where the real work gets done, is because they don't have to go through all of those hoops. We still get the permits that we need, you know, the SHPO and everything that you need for to get the conservation done. But it's nice because the farmers trust them. They're willing to work with them, and there's not all of that bureaucracy and red tape.
Yeah, Todd, I saw you nodding. You have something to add there?
Yeah, so in my presentation, I talked about the transition from watershed planning to watershed implementation.
In the broadcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And implementation, there's often a lot of barriers with implementation. Funding is definitely one of them. You know, water quality issues in the Midwest and Iowa, these are big issues, and they're expensive, and they're going to take a lot of resources. And so finding adequate funding to address these issues is going to be huge, and it is a barrier. You know, government programs alone aren't going to address some of the needs that we have. And that's where these partnerships are going to be important. Public-private partnerships, synchronization of those efforts, additional funding streams are going to be important. So that's one barrier. Mm-hmm. The other is boots on the ground. So you need individuals out there working one-on-one with farmers every day. They're kind of the linchpin to help make the implementation efforts successful. And if you don't have a local watershed coordinator, someone who's working with the farmer day in and day out to implement those practices, those watersheds are going to struggle. The environmental programs at Iowa Soybean Association, we have a staff of 10, and we cover the entire state. But we don't have the dedicated resources to stay at a watershed project for 5 or 10 years and be that on the boots person. And that's where the partnerships come in and are important. Oftentimes, the state will have a water quality watershed coordinator working in that capacity, but they're crucial. Mm-hmm. And there are other agencies and other groups and other departments that have folks that work one-on-one with farmers. On the technical side, you know, we do offer that assistance to farmers, but it's not in a capacity where we're there day in and day out in those watersheds. So, you know, as a partner in the Fishers and Farmers group, ag is there because we're the ones that are on the ground dealing with these issues day in and day out. You know, they're like the direct conduit to resource concerns in Iowa. I know when I first started at the Iowa Soybean Association, my boss, Roger Wolf, had mentioned that in Iowa, ag is the environment. You know, it's we have working lands. It's predominantly row crop. And so when working with farmers, we're working on working lands. And no farmer wants to see their resources gone either. And so they're the ones that when we talk about these solutions and ideas and new approaches, if it doesn't meet their muster, it's not going to happen. So it's important to have their buy-in.
So, you know, I, as a social scientist in the human dimensions branch, and not only myself, but my colleagues as well, we receive a lot of questions and requests for guidance on how to do things like stakeholder engagement. And oftentimes, you know, it's sort of a balance of how much can we actually engage people. One of the higher levels of engagement, of course, is collaborative conservation. If you're looking at the spectrum of engagement, which if you haven't heard of it, go Google it right now. It's really helpful. And so the first part of engagement is inform, and that's, you know, the least you can do, and sometimes that's all you can do. But then a really great engagement, it can all be great, but a more in-depth form of engagement is collaborative conservation. And so a lot of times the questions that are asked is, how can I be more collaborative? How can I do that collaboration? And so if there was somebody here in the studio right now sitting with us and they're working, you know, in some region for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they have maybe a refuge or an endangered species or something, and they want to know what the first step is, or they want to know some of the tips for how service staff can work more effectively with some of their stakeholders, or maybe in particular, Todd, commodity groups or private landowners, what are some of the tips that you would give them for starting out or for throughout the process?
I oftentimes talk about active versus passive engagement. You know, passive engagement, this is through trial and error. I've been at this with the Soybean Association for 16 years. And so on the passive side, postcards and the flyers. Trying to inform your constituents about something that's going on with a postcard or a flyer. You get a pretty low response.
Okay.
On the more active side, that's the individual calling. And, you know, you might make a phone call, or you might pull into a farmyard and talk to somebody. Or you start working through your partners who have a better connection with those local landowners. So for us, when we're working in a new watershed, the local soil and water conservation district, your district conservationist will go and actually have conversations with them and start talking about, who are your local leaders? Would they be interested? What kind of practices are they interested in working on? Would they be interested in a watershed project? And then from there, working with that local district, we can convene meetings and get a better understanding of what some of the issues are in that watershed. And then start our active engagement, where we start working with those local leaders one-on-one and bring in the partners. And one thing about partnerships is that it gives you the ability to have expertise that you may not have on your own staff.
Okay.
So we may be able to bring in a fish and wildlife expert on some topic that's of interest to those farmers in that watershed.
Yeah.
And likewise, if some of your staff are looking for outside folks that have understanding or knowledge on a topic, so maybe they're working with farmers, but they don't understand farming or farmers, that's when they can come back and work with the Iowa Soybean Association. Say, hey, we've got this program. How do we best work with farmers?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do we approach them? So I think when you're looking at this active versus passive, the active needs to be all-encompassing. You know, it needs to be working with the partners, understanding who has the expertise, going to the knowledge base or knowledge source at the local level, and starting from there.
I've got a couple questions about the things that you were talking about. Yeah. Mainly, so one of the things that we get asked a lot is about how to run better public meetings or meetings in general. And so I'm curious about, you said one of the steps that you were saying in there was, okay, we've kind of gotten some people where we know who we want to engage. What are some of the best practices that you would recommend for planning a meeting like that?
Well, one thing about a watershed meeting is the last thing you want to do is just spend 2 hours talking to them. You'll lose them quickly. The best meetings that we've had is where we talk about topics, but then we engage the producer or the farmer to get their feedback. There's a lot of questions. Our world is full of acronyms, so oftentimes we have to define what we're talking about and explain, you know, how it fits into the system. And then there's a lot of just education and outreach that takes place, and a dialogue between the farmer and whoever's there is very important. I've been to enough meetings where we've just had PowerPoint after PowerPoint, no engagement, no involvement, and then you think you had a good meeting, but was anybody listening?
Mm-hmm.
So really, to have that two-way dialogue is huge. Another way to have a successful meeting is, you know, I talked about this active engagement. We oftentimes turn to farmer leaders to invite their neighbors to come.
Oh, okay.
So rather than just sending an invitation out and saying, hey, we got a watershed meeting, can you come? I'll call on leaders and say, hey, can you call a couple neighbors of yours to come? So even though I wear a Soybean Association hat, I'm still not a known entity in the watershed where the farmer to farmer is.
Yep.
That peer network's huge.
Yep.
Yeah,
some of our watershed leaders meetings, we have the local farmer present to you know, that's doing the conservation on his farm. And he may not even be the best speaker or even like talking in front of people. But once he gets up there and sees that other people are listening, his neighbors are listening, then that really helps too. But, and other farmers really want to listen to another farmer. They don't want to listen to, you know, an agency person up there. Yeah. So that really helps too.
Yeah. Okay. It makes it real.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. You know, a farmer that they may be shy, but the message they have is real.
Yeah,
you know, they talk about what worked, what didn't work, what things to watch out for. Mm-hmm. They may even put a plug in for, yeah, this program works or this practice is really good.
And I think it makes it more powerful, too, coming from a shy farmer. If he's willing to stand up and talk about something, that's really powerful.
That kind of reminds me of some of the things Wiley Carr, who was a guest on our broadcast this week, he was mentioning to me earlier, and maybe you all could elaborate a teeny bit before we wrap up this conversation. He was thinking about how important it is to have some of those interpersonal communication skills and empathy. And I'm curious what you think of that, Heidi.
Yeah, we've been calling them soft skills in the watersheds that we work in. And Rob Pulliam, who's a biologist out of Missouri Department of Conservation, he says, you know, really what helps him is he goes and talks to the farmer in the community. He goes to have coffee with them. He really develops those soft skills by becoming part of the community, you know, a trusted person that they want to talk to. And he also calls it conservation marketing.
Huh.
And so really getting out there, knowing Joe's dog's name is Bud, you know, and just really getting to know the families and, you know, driving the landscape and really being part of the community really helps drive. And he said, instead of him going and knocking on doors, because I have county conservationists tell me all the time, I can't go knocking on doors. Instead of that happening, Rob says that now farmers are coming and knocking on his door asking him about funding.
Oh, wow.
So if you can find people, and not everybody has those soft skills, you know, there's a lot, not even some of our county conservationists have those skills, you know, that you think, oh, they're supposed to be working with farmers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so not everybody has those, but if you find the people that are, that really helps drive conservation.
Maybe bring them with you if you don't have the skills yourself.
Right, right. Yep.
Very cool. Well, on that note, we're going to wrap up. Thank you so much, Heidi Coyler here and Todd Sutphin. Thank you so much for being here and for doing our broadcast this week as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
So Heidi and Todd have also said that it would be okay if you have any other questions. You're welcome to contact them. And their emails are Heidi_Coyler@FWS.gov, and that's spelled HEIDI_KEULER@FWS.gov. And Todd's email is tsutphin@iasoybeans.com, and that's spelled tsutphin@iasoybeans.com. And if you'd like to email the Human Dimensions branch, you can do that at human_dimensions@fws.gov. We have several additional podcasts in the works. All podcasts can be found on the NCTC podcast page, which you can find by Googling NCTC podcasts, or you can subscribe to our iTunes page. Just search Human Dimensions Conservation in the podcast iTunes store, and when you scroll down, the podcast episodes will be there available. If you have ideas for future podcast topics, please email the HD branch as well. And that's it for today. Thanks for being with us.